Hi, my name is Amanda New, and this is Uncommon.
Hi, this is Ken Lau, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. All right, my guests this week, Amanda New and Ken Lau, co-founders of Ava. We're just talking before about Malaysia in particular. I don't know if you guys have ever noticed this, but I reckon the two most prominent, let's call it white-collar expats that live in Australia are, in my opinion, Malaysians or English, like Poms. That was the thing I noticed when I first got into the workforce working in like consulting and finance. It's like someone was either from KL, Penang, London, or Liverpool.
Wow.
It was always amazing to me. Why Australia, like, why does everyone go, first of all, how old were you guys when you came here? Like Zoe Lowe, who we know, she came here when she was like 10, 11.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys come here for uni or earlier?
I came here when I was about eight or nine, but I'm from New Zealand. So my parents met in New Zealand.
Gotcha.
But they grew up in Malaysia. Okay. Like Ken came here a little bit later.
Yeah, I think I came here when I was 16, I think.
Yeah.
So kind of like left halfway in high school in Malaysia and just rocked up here for year 11, year 12, basically.
Why is Australia like the place? It's going to be either here or like Singapore, right?
Yeah, I think for me at least, it's just family. I think like, well, my mom's sister's based here, so she's been here before, and it's just like, okay, I want to send the kids somewhere. What's familiar?
Mm.
Melbourne it is then.
Gotcha.
It was a really simple process for her.
Did you ask your auntie, did you ever ask her why she came here?
She came here because it's a really interesting one. I think she wanted to move out from the life from Malaysia because things can be quite challenging over there as well. You know, you're not afforded a lot of opportunities. And sometimes in those countries, you are the minority in some ways as well. And they are treated like that. So I think that's also one of the main reasons that people come over, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always wondered that. Like, why is it the thing? I think Zoe, yeah. So he would say to me, it was just like, you know, work more than anything.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, you have great opportunities, basically. Like, I mean, obviously, standard living is quite different. But I think, like, over here, like, if you were to compare life in Asia, and I'm not saying that's bad, yeah. Over here, you can get a decent job and have, like, you know, you can afford a lot of things. But it gets a bit challenging when you're starting out in those countries, I would say. You probably have to work longer hours and, like, the amount of output comparison to what you do over here doesn't equal, you know, it's not 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah, no, I am. Did you ever meet Zoe's friend, Maxine? Zoe had, like, a group of friends from Malaysia. Anyway, we've become quite close friends with Maxine and Jake, and they went back and had their tea ceremony wedding.
Mm.
They're getting married, but then like doing the official wedding in November in Thailand. Anyway, it was the first thing he commented to me is like, they were catching up with friends and like people who are young, it's like the economy's dominated by boomers, right?
Mm.
So people who are young just don't earn much.
Mm.
Yeah.
And because of that, he was like, it's so obvious now why so many people leave, because if you don't have family with a business or some sort of pathway, then like your opportunity to earn money is basically capped.
Yeah.
Mm. Which I found very interesting.
That's very true. And most people go back, they've got a booming family business that you can kind of build on as well. And so, yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, yeah.
What do you guys individually, maybe we'll start with you, Amanda. What was like, what's your earliest memory ever?
Earliest memory ever?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was my memory or if it was a story that my mom told me, which I kind of took as my own memory now. Yeah. I remember when I was probably around 2 or 3, I was in Malacca, in a little island near Malaysia, and I apparently went missing. My mom had left me, I think, at the playground for just a little bit. because she had to go do something and told me to stay there. But when she came back, I had disappeared and they had the entire hotel look for me. they eventually found me, but I was just sitting outside my hotel room door. So I was just waiting for everyone to find me there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. What about you? What's your earliest memory, Ken?
Of my Malaysia.
Just in general.
Wow. That's pretty deep. I would say, kindergarten, I would say. First thing I remember was just like playing kids, studying, you know, routine. I think my life was very routine based. I think we start really young. So the earliest memory is actually like waking up like 5 or 6 o'clock every single day, you know, having your breakfast, going to school and just continuing that constantly day in, day out, basically. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, my first memory is like, it's so distinct of fucking around with some cement on the side of my parents' house and then my mum smacking me for it. That's like it. Yeah, she's going to crack it at me later.
It's etched into your memory for life now.
For life, man. the reason why I did it was because we were at kindergarten and we were putting shapes into cement. Into Play-Doh.
Mm.
And so I saw like this fresh cement at home plus like bits of scrap wood that looked like shapes, like triangles and the one was like a circle. I was like, oh, pattern matching. This is the same thing. I'm just going to take this and do the
You're
same.
You're just learning.
Yeah. What did you guys think individually what you wanted to be when you were a kid?
I always wanted to be a doctor for some reason, but that never panned out because I realized that I came to a conclusion, I was like, oh, I'm probably not really book smart, so that option is probably off the table.
Yeah, right.
Really early on, basically. Then after that, I was like, all right, I took the Asian mentality. It's like, what's the highest earning potential? I'm just going
to...
Engineer.
Yeah, yeah.
What kind of engineering, basically? Electrical, okay. Aerospace is a bit too hard, so I'll go for the second hardest.
How old were you when you realized that?
To be honest, engineering came about last minute. Before engineering, I wanted to get into pharmacy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I did pharmacy for my, I think, year 12 internship and work holiday or something like that. I was like, oh, I really like the health aspect and running the business and combining both of it. So I was like, I wanted to be a pharmacy and spent one or two years working towards it. And then I didn't get into pharmacy because I missed a point from my VCE. I think it was 1 point for maths. That disallowed me from getting in and was devastated basically because it works so hard and it's like, all right, I'm lost right now. And then, you know, got guidance from like families. So, all right, if you're lost right now, let's just go back to the Asian way. And that's how I kind of end up engineering basically.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Isn't that so fucking ridiculous? It's like you'd have these marks and it would prevent people from doing it. Like my marks were shocking at uni. At high school.
Yeah.
Mm. But I missed the course I wanted to do by like 3 points.
Oh.
So stupid in hindsight. The amount of people, I wonder what the percentage is of people who stayed in that field having studied the degree. I mean, I know that's how the unis need a system, but I've always found it really odd. What about you, Amanda?
For me, I think I wanted to be a lawyer. I also missed out by, I think, like 0.15, and I wrote a letter to the university to say, please let me in. Did not let me in. And then I pivoted to psychology and became a neuropsych instead before life at Eva.
So how do you guys meet?
Ooh, when do we meet? It would have been after uni.
Yeah, definitely.
It was like a after exams sort of get together, mutual friends. What happened? I saw you.
Amanda said hi. Let's just put that on record right now.
Yeah,
right.
I said hi first because I saw you sort of darting around and not wanting to make eye contact with me. So said hi first. And then, we just got to talking.
Yeah, right.
The rest was history.
Who asked who on a date first?
Oh, that was me. I think I was definitely interested in Amanda, but I was a bit too shy back then. And I think Amanda gave me the opening, like, hey, what's your name? Because I kind of know everyone over here, but just don't know you. And I was like, my name's Ken. Okay, let me take it from here.
Do you remember the first date?
Yeah, definitely. I remember that. I want to make sure that I get this right.
Holy is.
Yeah, I definitely do remember the first day. And it was like, I think I told Amanda like the plan behind the first day, and she was like outrageously annoyed. It's like, wow, that, I thought it was quite candid, but it wasn't candid. So the first day we had was actually at the zoo, and she's like, why was the zoo? Because, you know, we kind of like each other and we could avoid like awkward, like, silences basically, because like you have things to look at base and all, and like, yeah, you can explore. So it was quite natural back then.
Engineered
in some ways.
Dude, and this is so, oh my god, I can see both your personalities immediately. Like, psychologist wants to get to know people, sit down, have a glass of wine, chat for 3 hours, and yeah, wow. That is amazing. And you're just like, things.
Yeah, I know.
That's fucking hilarious, man. Okay, so yep, you both had these careers before you started Eva. What, if you both think back to that period of time, maybe you go first, Amanda, what's like the greatest insight you had, you've taken from that career and you've applied in business?
Ooh, I think, so in neuropsychology, it's the study of the brain, behavior, and, you know, cognition. But a lot of it relies on the interpretation of data, tests, and things like that. I think being able to think through what are some confounding variables that could lead to this particular result and work through that, I think I've taken that into business, so that, you know, what is a correlation versus what is causation? I think that's a really big, big part of decision making. And I definitely learned that from neuropsychology.
Interesting. And just for those playing at home, neuropsychology, how does that differ to psychology?
So psychology, clinical psychology, is different to clinical neuropsychology. What I do is more around assessment and diagnoses of brain-related disorders. So a lot of what I did particularly was within aging and dementia, so diagnosing Alzheimer's and all the different types of dementias there. I also worked predominantly in the private sector, so a lot of referrals from the government and sort of medical legal cases, and making those assessments around, can this person be a witness for a case? Do they have capacity to make decisions, things like that?
So I had no idea that there was neuropsychology, because I just assumed that there was clinical psychologists and psychiatrists.
Mm.
So this sort of sounds like it's an in-between stage.
Yeah, definitely right? Between neuroscience mixed with psychology, so people, cognition.
Yeah, interesting. What about you, Ken? Things you picked up
from engineering.
Yeah.
I would say problem solving, actually. Engineering is everything. It's just solving problems and like identifying them. And I think went to MIT, literally trained from first year to like identify them, solve it as quickly as you can, as logically as you can as well. So I really do think that that's something I brought out. I don't think anything I've learned in engineering contributed to at least the business, sorry to say, but that was one skill, I think. And maybe like project managing, because you get a fair bit of things happening as well. They chuck you into like group projects, like, you know, do you kind of learn how to work with stakeholders and like understand like how to influence and get someone to like actually submit their part of the project for you to finish a group project. So stuff like that really helped.
Yeah, I mean, problem solving is going to be a massive component.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's just so much stuff to deal with when you're building a product.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Funny, like a lot of people will come in for interviews and service people will come in and like they all want the other type of company.
Mm.
But then, like, I just find that so ironic. But yeah, it's people underestimate how complex solving problems is for products. Sometimes it's almost too hard.
It's a lot harder than services. Very hard. Yeah.
Because services, you can sometimes fluff your way through stuff. Sometimes, like, with you can with products, but sometimes something is just literally not possible. Like, physics prevents you, right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like, our product, if it doesn't stand up, it doesn't stand up, you know, like.
That's what our return trial is there.
Yeah.
It kind of keeps us accountable.
So yeah.
Our insurance policy.
Yeah, right. Interesting. We're going to talk about that, the 365 days returns. So I think you guys, it was 2016 That was like the earliest note that I could find. 2017, sorry. Mm. That was in the Business Founder. Why? What was this conception? Like, how did this begin? Who wants to tell us?
Can get right into it.
So after like work, after leaving uni, I did, I think, 2 years of engineering, and I was like, nah, this isn't for me for a career, because I always wanted to run a business during my engineering career. I did engineering just for the sake of actually finishing and actually getting something. Yeah. I can't believe I actually studied 4 years for that, yeah. for that reason. Then immediately after work, I actually gone on an eBay. I opened up an eBay business. I'd done heaps of eBay businesses before, but this one was a different scale. So I actually built two direct-to-consumer brands on eBay itself. The first one was a low-end mattress brand, and the second one was a mountain bike brand. Mm-hmm. Same logic, you work in manufacturing, bring your own brands. The only difference in eBay is that you sell it for cheaper, and the customers don't actually really care about the brands. Even though you have one, they care about the prices. Then from there, I think it's a bunch of stuff happened, then realized that eBay wasn't really like the place that we want. No, I wanted to be to build a brand, because it's about price competition. So Amanda was just finishing up her master's then, and we're like, hey, it's been 1 year, quite challenging with a couple of roadblocks as well. Let's kind of pivot the whole entire business to like something more direct to consumer base.
Gotcha.
And I think during the same time, like the whole trial period of 120 nuts came about, we were like, ooh, it was like a light bulb moment. That's like, hey, that can actually solve the customer centricity side of things. And then obviously we were like, okay, we kind of need one product for scale. Like, you know, how maybe Amazon started with books, or maybe Kogan started with TV. You need one flagship product. And because I was already in the mattress business, I was like, okay, if we actually turn this low end to a high end product, obviously which much better materials as well, this can be a flagship product where you could sell 1,000 of it and actually just build a business off it. Mm. So that's how the idea kind of came about.
And the flagship product was mattress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So you basically got dragged into this.
I mean, voluntarily.
No, but do you know what I mean? Like, I remember when I started doing this stuff, at least when it was just the podcast, I had recorded episodes, and then I was like, I can't edit this. I can't do this. Mm. And I basically asked Lauren to do it.
Mm.
But then after, you know, she was in on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, yeah, it's one of those situations where you got to convince people and drag them in.
Mm.
What was like for you the insight of like, okay, wow, this is like a significant business? When was that moment? Was it at the end of the year, or had it started materializing in your head before then?
Yeah, I was in a really weird spot. So when Eva first started becoming, you know, we launched in May, I think 2017, I had just got a job in neuropsychology.
Yeah.
And so I was working part-time neuropsych, part-time Eva, sort of after hours. And then my goal at the time was to help out Eva where I could, but I was still focused on neuropsych, because I had to do a 3,000-hour registrar program to be fully endorsed. And that took me about, I think, 2 years, 2.5, 3 years to get done. But during that time, I think very quickly, after about a year or so, I dropped my hours in neuropsych, picked up a few days at Eva. Then I went full-time about 3 years ago now.
Wow.
So that was helpful in the sense that I had also just got my registrar program approved, and I was like, cool, I'm done. Let's get out of here. Let's go Eva full time.
Yeah, right. Interesting. Hmm. Did you have a similar thing where you were just realizing that this career wasn't for me?
Yeah, I think I was fortunate to experience neuropsych and understand how much it's a lot of structure and a lot of standardized testing. So everything that you do needs it's very routine, and therefore it helps in the sense when you're interpreting results, you can really hone in on, you know, what this means for a person. I think I was always really fascinated with understanding people and what this means for them in terms of their future. What Eva provided me was outside of the box thinking. Yeah. It was not routine. Everything was up in the air. Everything was on fire, and it really made me flex flex a little bit more in terms of more unique problem solving
yeah.
that I thought that was really exciting, that neuropsych couldn't really offer me because it was very routine in nature.
Gotcha.
It was all engineered.
Yeah, it was all engineered. So 3 years ago you went full-time. That would have been what, 2019?
2019, the start of 2020.
Start of 2020. Mm. Okay, wow, what a time to start.
Yeah.
Because I'm always intrigued around what those first years are like. So you guys are a bootstrap business, right? No VC funding, anything like that. All bootstrap. When was that moment where you probably both realized that you were onto something and it was scalable and that this was a legitimate business? Not maybe not so much when you went full-time, but when you started hiring staff.
Mm.
When was that moment?
I think we brought in the first staff.
Within six to eight months,
I would say. Yeah.
Right.
But I think like a lot of businesses, you know, we saw that this kind of business, this business had success in other regions, maybe in Australia and obviously from the States as well. So that was proof there. And obviously there was some backing as well in terms of like the eBay business. So there was a lot of data and it was like, it's more about execution that if you get this right, there's a chance that this business can actually succeed. Mm. So I think we were quite confident in that sense. But obviously the execution part was a bit of the unknown because we had to build the marketing arm. You know, eBay is like they bring customers to you, you know, and it's your job just to convert them through the best price of picture. But when you have your own website, you have to do everything and bring your own customers and spend money. Yeah, so that was unknown. And that was something that we worked out a long time to try to figure out.
Yeah, how long was that? Because like getting that cut through, like there's the short-term aspect of like getting sales, like that direct response type stuff is could be Google Ads, social, whatever it may be. But then there's also like a longer term brand development. What do you think is like, as the marketer, what's the perfect mix for Eva today? And how long did it take to realize that?
I think for us, we did it a little bit differently. We've always put the business first and brand second. And okay. I think, that resulted in us rebranding, I think, 3 to 4 times. And we've only been around for, I think, 5 years.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a test and learn approach. So at the start, it was very much a sleep company and it was blue stuff. Blue was our main color and you've got the little moon here and a little star there. And then as we continued to diversify our product range, we realized that it's a lot more potential than just being a sleep company. We want to be a home company. We want to create a lifestyle and create a real brand. And we moved from there to what we see now, which is the green logo. I think it's also emphasizing sort of being a little bit more sustainable and being more responsible and accountable for the products that we put out to the world. I think with mattresses at the start, it had probably tripled, right, in terms of the competitor base, which is sort of indicative of how there was a lower entry barrier to entry for mattress companies into the space. Of course, now I think with the macroeconomy being as it is now, it'll be interesting to see how companies fare over the next year or so.
Yeah, the next year, next 12 to 18 months is going to be interesting. I think a lot of people who have a lot of leverage or built up a lot of leverage are going to feel the pinch. Over the That's why I'm intrigued by you guys, because you've never taken on outside funding. So you're not really going to have the short-term pressure of having to always cap raise.
Yeah. It's been positive cash flow from the start. So I think that was the foundation of the business that was built. So obviously, we didn't over leverage, we didn't over hire. We always do what we can with what we have, essentially. So obviously things was a little bit slower, but you know.
It's slower, but it just means that in 20 years you'll be around.
Yeah.
And maybe others won't.
Yeah, exactly. It's the furniture business, or at least in business, it's a long game. It's a marathon, it's not a sprint.
Yeah.
I mean, some businesses are sprint when you have to like get market share, for example, like maybe Uber, you know, winner kind of takes all. But as a retail business, like I think customers, they change their loyalty over time as well.
Well, yeah. I just read 2 brilliant books. One is called How Brands Grow. Which is, so there's this new field of evidence-based marketing, which has come out of South Australia University, and there's a institute called Ehrenberg Institute that Coca-Cola and Uber and all these major brands basically finance, and they basically just do statistical analysis on what it actually results in growth. And it was very intriguing to look at those numbers and how that actually results in brands growing over the long term. Like, you can focus on your current customers, which is great, but acquiring new customers is the ultimate way, because loyalty is not what people think it is. But those loyalty programs that you see, like, you know, your Qantas frequent flyer points, Flywise, etc., actually don't really make much money. I found very interesting. They're almost like surefire ways, and like discounting and all that sort of stuff is a great way to lose money over time. So how do you build a customer base that likes your product in the long term? You probably do things like what you guys are doing, like guarantees, you know, bonus, some sort of bonus thing, or bundling of product into a bigger package is much smarter than just, hey, we got a mattress on sale. Mattress on sale. It's 70% off end of financial year. Buy a new mattress. To recover that revenue lost through the sales, the volume never, ever meets it. That's the analysis that they found. Found really interesting. So the product range today, how do you look at that bundling and what you currently have? So maybe just give everyone like an overview of the current products you have by segment in the home, and then you don't have to say, but like maybe what you're thinking about in the long term, what you want to cover. Who wants to go?
You can go for it.
Definitely. We started with the mattress, and I think very soon we decided, okay, we're going to expand, and we did the bed frame because it was most logical step, because as a customer, you buy a bed frame mattress. So with that introduction, the business grew quite significantly because of the bundles. Essentially, average order value went up quite high. Then we moved into the sofa category, was our entry into living room. Then with that, we moved into the coffee tables. So we did, I think, a square and rectangle one as well, because it was a good bundle. And then we realized that living room is a little bit different from mattress, because, you know, you can have, you know, X percentage of the population buying the same mattress because it's about just comfort and not how it looks. But living room is about, I like this style of sofa, you know, with legs, without legs, and so on. So, all right, we need to have a couple of styles, basically. And yeah, that's basically why we moved into the second sofa, which is the Everyday sofa that was launched probably like maybe 4 months ago.
So you got, sofas, mattresses, base. The base is fascinating to me. I was talking earlier off camera about like this issue we've got at home, the master bedroom. We've been wanting to replace the base on the bed for so long, but the master bedroom, a crack in the roof appeared, and because the homeowner had not fixed a water leak issue. But once that is done, we'll probably get the base sorted. It's just that we're going to like Europe and Thailand for Maxine and Jake's wedding, so we're going to wait till that's done. But yeah, so you got the base, which is super interesting. What are you eyeing off? Are you eyeing off any further products at the moment?
Yeah, we've got, I think this year, this financial year, I think we've got 5 or 6 product launches, basically. And obviously that would change accordingly to, you know, the macro economy and like the business needs as well. But the products that we have launching right now, we've worked on it for almost a year and a bit as well. And obviously it's same logic in terms of expansion, because now we've got, obviously we are as a business acquiring new customers, but we've got current customers that, you know, got mattresses and, for this case, mattress and bed frame. And it's like, oh, I like your living room stuff, but I don't like this sofa. So it's like kind of wait for a different style, for example. So our job right now is to understand like one part of the business, like how can we maximize the living room where people come in, they will at least leave with like one product at least. And like we kind of got sold out with the mattress and bed frame for now. Now living room, we focus on that. That was a couple of products that's also definitely is coming up from that side.
if you look at those five or six, is the majority of them in new categories or current categories you have and expanding them?
One of it's a new category, and the remaining of it is just doubling down on the current category.
All the stuff that's worked.
Because, you realize that we have so many people that view our mattress, but it's a small percentage of customers that actually buy from us. So we're like, we start asking like why, and first of all it's like maybe, you know, their needs are not met, you know, they need something else, probably they need something more customizable, for example, you know. So we had all these questions. Obviously different products have different questions. Like the bait base is like aesthetic. If you don't like the aesthetic, you're not gonna get it. I'm gonna get something that looks, fits my life and my room, basically. So we try to understand what's that different aesthetic.
So when it comes to product development, it sounds like you guys surveyed people.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. A lot.
How is that?
How
do you do that as well? Like, do you just do a mass mail out and then curate a bunch of people of the people who answer? How do you do it?
When we first started, it was that we would reach out to our mailing list and ask whoever would want to be involved in providing feedback. And there was quite a few number of people who was, I think, quite strong advocates of the brand, that they wanted to see what would be the next product that we put out, or just genuinely interested and just wanting to chat to us, I think.
Yeah, right.
And then since then, now it's just part of our email flows. So after a particular period of time that they've had our product, it's just sort of a mail out and say, hey, we've got this program called the EVA Roundtable, where we interview customers for any product research and just general research around preferences. And yeah, whoever signs up gets added to the list. And so whenever we do interviews, they're like 1 hour Zoom interviews and we ask a ton of questions, and yeah, we just reward them with a gift card.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause not enough brand. That was one thing this book's work about, is not enough brands do their research on their customer base. But there's definitely research of, like, you know, looking at the market, Google search trends, all that sort of stuff, but not actually surveying customers.
I think there's
the most important thing.
Yeah, there's this. We used to do desktop research, but we realized there's only so much that it can really tell you unless you really just speak to the customer directly.
Yeah.
And of course, segmenting by, you know, psychographics and things like that.
So, okay, we're talking earlier about product development. You got five, six new products. What does that pipeline look like? And from the development to actual finish, and particularly I'm intrigued by, so you got this round table. You obviously do interviews, chat about it as a team, and then what, you bring it over to Ken, and then you start chatting to his team about, like, can this be made? And then he goes and has a look, and then you bring it to your manufacturer. What does that sort of look like?
That's a really great question. I think Amanda and I think when the first few products, we did that, but I think over time we built a team, and we've taken ourselves a little bit away from the decision making in terms of what products, because then it becomes biased that we just want a new sofa for our house, and, you know, let's push that. So we broke it down to design, development, and the product team. And I think the round table definitely starts very early on with the product team, where they find out about the customer's life. It's more about understanding, all right, you bought, just say, a mattress from us. It's like, what's next? You know, why are you going to buy it? Like, and what you can look for and price range, and what do you do? Understand them. Then obviously we got our personas basically, and then we ask them like, oh, what would Sally do in 2 years' time? So the product team would start researching the market, and obviously from a business sense, it's like, all right, Ken, Amanda, like, where are we going? And then obviously we've got a strategy. It's like, all right, we want to be the number one brand over this X amount of time. Let's break it down to steps, and like, how can we grow? Obviously revenue is a driver as well, and like really profitable, high gross margin products at the same time. So they'll find, all right, how can we, as a small company, how can we extract the highest growth potential with what we have right now? So obviously it comes to like, we've got so many products that we can create at our fingertips, then that's where you kind of make the decision that, all right, for example, let's create a sofa that we can sell at $3,000, for example, and we can sell X amount in comparison to creating a product that you can sell at $20, essentially. So obviously that's how we do it. Then obviously once we decide that, lots of research, lots of documents have been created, we move into designing the product. I was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. Let's do some concept. Then design team comes in with the brief, basically like, for example, we're going to do sofa. And like, this is done, this is for this customer essentially. And this is a price point, and this is how potentially it might look like. And they will do a concept. Once the concept's up, basically speak to the rest of the business for like sign off, like, hey, can Amanda, supply chain, finance, what do you guys think about this? And marketing as well, do you guys think you can sell this? After all that sign off, you're like, great. Concept done, let's move into prototyping. We create it in Australia. It's like, let's go to a local guy, like, let's make this up to see actually can you stand and, you know, how it looks like.
Yeah, what does it look like?
Yeah, and that takes about maybe a month, depending how busy the local guy is, essentially. And from there, it's like, great, we've got this. It looks great. Can we sign this off? Okay, let's live with it. So the design team will bring it home. It's like, let's see how it is. Is it too low, too short? Is it like, is the fabric not great? And you go through the iteration a couple of times. And then once you're ready to go,
User testing.
This is like the style of it. Like,
so what was that about testing? What, like, you send it to people?
So sometimes we ask the design team to bring it home, live with it. You know, for example, if it's a bookshelf, we'd be like, bring it home and put books in it and see how it stands up over time. Are there dents? How is it like to assemble? But we also test it in-house. So the design team would get little groups of people to come in and assemble it together. They would ask some questions. How was the assembly? How would you rate it? What would you improve? What didn't you like? What did you like? And from there, that would feed into the next iteration of the product to trying to solve for some of those friction points that would have identified. And we basically get to a point where majority of people, 80-20 rule, are happy with the product before we go, yep, this is it. This is our final golden sample. Let's go send it off to our manufacturers offshore to replicate that for us before. And then that in itself is a process because it's we're not there, which means a lot of it is done over WeChat, over Zoom, Google meetings, week on week. In addition to that, there's also the product team who is also involved in a lot of the commercial sensitivities, making sure we hit our bill of materials. And so as we continue to think about mass manufacturing these products, a lot of the economies of scale come into there as well. Yeah. So do all that and then it comes back.
Do you guys use the same manufacturer or do you pick manufacturer based on product? How does that sort of work?
I actually choose specific manufacturers for different products. I think in manufacturing, no one can do everything. Either you do a mattress very well, and or you do a sofa. And we actually want them to do that very well because, like, if you're going to do like 10 different products, it means that you don't have focus. It could be good for a company with like good diversification, but as a manufacturer that's not good at all. So all our manufacturers are very specific with what their craft is.
By the way, just quickly, I would be fascinated if, just based on the way that your brand is, if Ava did like a series where you did a deep dive on how things are built. Ooh. Last night I was watching a video on how mattresses are made. There was not much great stuff out there. But it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's just like,
there's a lot involved.
Yeah, just the user stuff that most people don't see. But I think that's it because as a user, you get it, it's like, oh, it's perfect. It fits my life. Like,
yeah.
But the things that we have to figure out what you guys need, like the users need to actually fit that.
Well, this is the thing is like people just look at a price and design and all that sort of stuff. And sometimes you don't realize how much goes into it. I think that adds a layer to understanding why you pay what you pay.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the reason we do that is because like we've, the ethos that we decide, it's like, hey, we just don't want to be another furniture company that gets something off the shelf. Like, if you're going to do something, we're going to make an improvement to what things are at the moment. And there's a lot of challenges with the furniture industry. Like, you'll go, hey, I'm just going to buy this sofa. I'm going to wait for 16 weeks and they're going to make it. That's great. And that's a problem. Great. And it's not even, it's off the shelf. It's nothing. You don't solve your needs, basically. So we're like, all right, let's change it up. Let's get in stock. But if you're going to stock like a few hundred sofas across Australia, we have to make sure that the mass will want it. Then when you want the mass, you have to be customer centric from your product as well. So I think it's also our supply chain and the way we do the business needed us to ensure that our products are very customer-centric as well, because some sofa companies would sell a lot of sofas, but things that they have like 100 or 200 different types of sofa out there. Mm. But our business, we only have like 5 or 6 product lines, but they're high volume because like it's acceptable across a whole range of like different consumers that wants it because it solves like their daily lives.
So for the manufacturing and supply chain sort of things, what's changed and what hasn't changed in the last 12 months?
Ooh, I don't know where to start. It's been very stressful. Let's give it that way.
Apart from the usual stuff of like containers are fucking 10 times the price of what they were.
Things are longer. Things are more expensive. But I think we've got a good handle. We haven't overstocked quite a fair bit. I think our biggest challenge right now is actually just... the biggest challenge right now is not being able to fly over to like sort things out. Things are taking longer to sort out because like there's no travel. No, you have to sort things out too.
Because you can't go to mainland China.
Yeah, we can't go there and go on the production line like solve this. You have to teach them like to have instruction. You have to create a PDF. So you can imagine how quick you can if I sit down here with you to say, hey, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
You know, things are just moving fast. So things are really slow from our end because of that. We get it done, but I think the travel makes it quicker.
Before COVID, we used to travel there every year, maybe 2 times a year, just to speed things up in terms of product development. But comparing ourselves to that.
It's a quick flight, man. This is what people don't realize of like, I remember that period of like 2016 to 19, everyone's like, why don't so many Chinese from the mainland immigrate here? And it's like, dude, it's an 8-hour direct flight basically from the southern cities.
Yep.
So it's very quick, but it's wild. So they still don't allow people to come to the mainland unless you're a citizen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It's challenging. So like,
how does that make any sense when they're like the biggest manufacturer in the world? That is crazy.
Yeah. Mm. Tell me about it. So lots of brands have to work around it. And like, especially brands that do their own product development, it's just painful. You can see so many steps in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, we have to be beside them to teach them. And we're doing it online.
And what's the vibe from the staff with the manufacturers that you're working with? Like, they must find it shockingly painful.
Our manufacturers are pretty good, I think. We've done a great job in terms of sourcing great relationships, but it's just, I think they're frustrated with the situation not being there because they are experienced and they come from places where they actually just travel up to solve a problem. And like myself, I've done it as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's just an additional paperwork that's needed to for something so simple.
And because it's been, if you think about it, for those on the mainland, it's been 3 years really since they, any form of travel has been happening. That, like, there was no doubt the introvert in me was speaking before about being introverted, extroverted, ambiverted. There was a period of time that first year of lockdowns I kind of enjoyed it.
Yes.
But I can, like, when we hit the two year mark, it really, really started to wane on me.
Yeah, definitely.
So I can imagine it would be shocking. Like, we know some people who are in Shanghai and dude, the lockdowns there have been intense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very definitely. Yeah, I think
that affected us a bit.
Affected, yeah, a little bit, basically. Mm. But I think we've got things under control. I think, like, we just have to work around it, yeah?
Yeah.
Just adapt.
What's the city for manufacturing of furniture?
That's a lot, actually. Yeah. There are a couple of hubs across China. So I think we did a really great decision at the start. Like, we consolidated a lot because... in 1 or 2 cities really close by.
Mm.
So once we scale up, we can consolidate our products in like containers basically. So sure. So instead of like things being spread around too far apart and having too much stock, we can reduce our stock. And that was really helpful during COVID.
Right. So you can have, because container, that what's the thing that everyone's talking about, like container optimization?
Yes.
That's now like a word.
Yeah. That we planned that before because I think the reason why we planned that was because we are a bootstrap company. So we were like, you have to maximize that. So that was early in the planning. And then obviously with like supply chain problems and stuff that worked in our favor as well. So obviously you scale up, now we can mix like mattress, bed frame, sofa, but you just increase the frequency of how many containers come in.
Mm.
But instead of bringing in a lot of stock that lasts 3 months basically. So that's helped us, to get to where we are over the last 2 years.
You guys procure your own supplies and then send it to the manufacturer, or do you purely let them handle that and just deal with like and just focus on yourselves being a product company design, iterate, all that sort of stuff, prototype, and then just allow them to handle it.
It's a mix, isn't it?
Mix. But most, I think, like, to make our life easier, we definitely get them to do it. So basically, the relationship that we have with all the manufacturers and the studs, like, we make it very clear. It's like, your job is we're going to work together as a partner, and we will commit, and we don't work with many manufacturers. Mm. You can speak to our references. We'll work with one. We'll scale up with you guys.
Yeah.
But your job is to make great products and ensure that when it leaves, it's perfect. Our job is to sell as many. So it's a win-win situation. We're very clear. And every time they cross that, I'll decide, like, hey, you can sell more if you do this. It's like, hey, remember that conversation. It's our job to sell and design products. Your job is to make sure that nothing goes wrong.
Yeah.
Because they do like to try to help, but I think, like, you just have to be quite clear and your core skills.
I can see that. Like, they feel like it's being like an extra level of service.
Mm. Mm. But I think depends on companies. Yeah. Like, our core skill is that. And, like, I mean, we can take suggestions, but sometimes, like, yes, but just don't stray away from your focus.
Yeah. I can imagine that. So, okay. Let's touch on the 365 days thing. How did this come about? Why? Because Jacob bought a mattress for me. Was it a mattress, Jacob? A bed. Okay.
Mm.
Why?
So the 365-day trial, I think it probably came off the bat of being confident that our product development process was in good shape. I think so the last 3-4 years was trying to build up a playbook of how to do product development and how to understand our customers so that, for example, the product team, their number one goal is to ensure the success of a product, which means involving many aspects of research and customer sizing with Mark and things like that. I think we just really back the quality of our products. So much work goes into it that we know that these products will last the test of time. Mm. And 365 days should be the minimum period of time that these products are with you.
Yeah.
I think a little bit of understanding where we market to is also important. So, for instance, we often call our types of customers the IKEA graduates in the sense that, well, you might not.
Hey, it's true. He's looking at IKEA.
Well, I mean, it's not a bad thing because, you know, when you move into a new place, often you'll have no furniture. Money's a bit tight, so you just need to get furniture in stat. You just need a table and you need a chair. And so you go to IKEA and get everything that you need. But then, you know, a year or so later, you're like, hey, maybe I do need a better table.
Yeah. Yeah. It starts to deteriorate.
Yeah. And that's where Eva comes in. And I think that understanding that customers who come to us at that point in time, they're willing to invest in a little bit more quality of a product.
Mm.
We back our quality to stand more than 365 days as well.
So those brand-based product elements that are more marketing than physical product, what else is there that exists? Like we spoke before about, so we got the 365 guarantee, there's bundles.
Mm-hmm.
What else have you got there that you've looked to develop over the last couple of years?
I think it's also good to mention that the products don't use tools, and that's a very important part of the design ethos that we have. I think a big friction that comes out from buying furniture is putting the furniture together, assembly and also disassembly, because we are quite a transient sort of nation. And if you're moving from one place to the next, the headache involved in moving, just being able to disassemble your bed frame, it's a stress that shouldn't exist. And I think that's what we want to infuse for all of our products. It shouldn't be as stressful as it is now.
Gotcha. And one more thing as well is that we want to solve like the long wait times. So we work towards having all our products being able to have next day delivery.
Mm.
So if you want a couch tomorrow, you can just jump online, purchase it, arrive tomorrow.
Do you mean like the long wait times that are existing just across the board right now?
Yeah. Oh, just the process, because we flipped the whole entire thing, because the furniture industry is not really customer centric. It's more about going to a big showroom and like having 200 different sofas and sitting on it for 2 hours to decide what you like. For us, it's like we have got two really customer centric products here that fits your needs.
Mm.
And we back them. We know it works. And so we stock a lot of them so you can buy it the next day.
Yeah, that is interesting, because I remember once we bought a product from one of your competitors and the wait time was 20 weeks.
Mm-mm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I think the model was
fucking painful.
The model is also different because they would probably not have the product in stock. So they would get a bunch of orders and then put it into a listed purchase. Mm. And then that's why it takes 16 to 20 weeks to come.
Which is beyond painful.
Mm. Absolutely. It's like if you can go to the store and buy a phone, you know, immediately, I mean, it should be the same for any product lines as well. It's that they just, like all the products, like the phone's really customer centric, right? So you just have to bring that towards this industry. Mm.
And it's exacerbated right now because of supply chain issues. Like I remember we were speaking about moving in here and there's that coffee table that's out there. It took 6 months to get
6
here.
6 months?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we bought it from Lounge Lovers or something like that.
I hope you'll really like it.
Fucking, yeah. It's like one of those classic, it's not terracotta, but it's terrazzo.
Oh, yeah. It looks really nice.
It looks good, but it's not real terrazzo. I thought we were getting some, you know, fancy real type thing, but it's like, it's ceramic.
How'd you feel after receiving 6 months later?
Very annoyed. I was just like, why?
Yeah.
It's quite amazing that like there's no doubt. I remember hearing this thing in one of these other marketing books I've been reading recently about how whenever people are buying, we are risk-taking individuals.
Mm.
But the moment we have to make the transaction, we are risk-averting individuals.
Mm. Mm.
So it's kind of one of those things that there's a known – it's known in the sort of scientific realm that – the moment after you buy something, there's an instant form of regret, no matter what.
Mm.
So I kind of got it with that product. Like we bought it December and I think within a month I was like, do we actually need this? Do we want this set up? Like, do you know what I mean?
That's where the trial comes in basically, just in case.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It's very, very, very good. I'm intrigued to see what the results are going to be on that. Mm. What... You guys do a few interviews. I've listened to a few of yours, like Lady Brains and all those sort of shows. What don't you guys get asked that you wish you could talk about for the business?
Hmm. I think people and culture.
Okay. Why and what specifically?
I think, so, you know, these last few years have been really tough for everyone. We had grown, I think, about 10 people before COVID started to now about 30. And so a lot of growing pains we would have gone through. Like, yes, there is one part, which is selling the product, creating the systems for success. But the other part to it is our role has now changed to becoming more focused on people to help do those things for us. We're no longer on the tools as we used to be. And I think that shift for us in our jobs to off the tools and helping to empower and motivate people in a time that's really, really tough, I think that has been a really interesting learning curve for sure.
Have you guys got any advice for me? Because I'm trying to hand over more and more. We're going away August, September. Mm. Sometimes it's so dumb. Like someone will say something to me like, oh, yeah, I can do that. And I'm like, yeah, you can. Why am I doing this?
Documentation. I think something that we've pushed very hard the last 12 months is a culture of writing and document everything, basically. Like everything needs to be a playbook. And I know it sounds a bit corporate-y, I guess, but it works for any size of business because then you'd be able to hand on like, all right, this is the keys to the kingdom, so how to get things done and the steps essentially. And if you're stuck, then yeah, I can come in to help you. But yeah, we've done that across it and definitely helped a scale because I think prior to that everything's up in your brain and like if you need something I have to call him you can't do that anymore once you become a bit bigger. I think it forces you to do that.
How big's your handbook or playbook at the moment?
Wow.
How many pages?
There are several. So across all the different departments, they have their own playbooks.
No shit.
I think each playbook is 100 pages.
Yeah, okay. We've got one internally, it's like 50 pages or something.
Yeah, across the whole entire company, thousands, if not, we just keep on building on them, basically, and refining them. And sometimes it gets lost, they build new ones, basically, in version 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, I am guilty of, forgetting to document stuff like that and just so people know.
Yeah, it's hard. Don't get me wrong. I struggle as well.
When you're a workaholic.
Yeah.
I'm a workaholic. like to work.
Yeah. And when you want to work, it's like, it's so much easier for me just to do this than actually document this. But I think, yeah, I think you just have to force yourself to do it and understand, like, if you want to go on a holiday, you need to.
Yeah, you absolutely need to. For both of you individually, what, maybe can you go first? What do you want for the next 2 years?
The next 2 years. Wow. I definitely want to focus on business. I think there's so much more potential. I think we're just getting started. Definitely want to grow the business even more. But I think at the same time, try that from maybe from a career side of things and just see the people within the business grow and provide those opportunities to those guys. Secondly, probably a little bit more of a work-life balance. I think the last, starting business is challenging, and I think you understand that. Mm-hmm. I think we've given a lot to the business where I think it's becoming a bit exhausting, and sometimes like, oh, who are we without the business? And I think like trying to find that balance, or not that we're going to stop working, but I think having clear distinction that, all right, we're going to go home, we're going to stop. I think going to have to start working on that. Otherwise, if you continue this, it's like, you become the business basically.
Yeah. Do you guys have a holiday planned? That's a no. Yeah, fuck.
We got engaged this year, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, we did.
That wouldn't have happened if we didn't have documentation to go on holidays.
Where did he propose?
In Queenstown, New Zealand.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a fucking great spot.
It's a great spot. Yeah. And no one was there because apparently it wasn't open to Australians. So
I forgot I was a Kiwi.
Yeah. We got through it.
How'd you go?
How was her partner? So
really?
We rock up to the airport and it's like, you know, you can't travel into New Zealand because it's not open for Australian yet. But luckily, Amanda is a Kiwi. Amanda's like, oh, okay.
So did you travel on your Kiwi passport?
No, I didn't have one. So I had no idea that I was still a Kiwi, obviously, because I was born there. Of course I am.
Can you have dual passports?
Yes. Yes.
Do you have dual?
I just haven't renewed my Kiwi one, but I am eligible for one.
Because I've got a mate, Tender, who will be listening to this, and he's originally from Zimbabwe, moved to New Zealand, then they moved to Queensland, and he is like adamant that he's never going to get an Australian passport. And I'm like, mate, it is so much more beneficial to have both.
Mm.
But he's going to listen to this and be like, see, I told you.
Yeah. We got into New Zealand and got engaged.
Yeah, all you need to do is be going to Queenstown and get engaged. That's cool. So have you guys made any plans yet?
I think we've gone for two holidays now. I think New Zealand, and then I think a month later we went to Malaysia for a wedding. It was a good break. I think it was like 2 months apart basically. So I think we owe it to the team to stick around for a little bit more. Yeah. And I think we haven't got a plan yet because like I think like we spoke just then, the macro stuff is going to be a bit more challenging.
Complex.
So like we want to be on the ground to solve it if anything arises. And like I think if anything, holiday plan will come really last minute, like a few weeks before.
So do you think that you guys are going to is there expectation you're going to do tea ceremony and a wedding? What are you going to do there?
Oh my gosh, I'm so stressed.
Have you had this conversation yet?
I have had many conversations, but I think we want to keep it simple.
Okay.
We got a date.
We've got the date down, but it's probably just starting to do stuff. I think I've got a bit of decision paralysis at the moment.
We'll make some. I think we're deadline driven, so we'll work towards the deadline.
Which is in
5 months' time, I think.
Lauren and I basically project manage the wedding. It's But we can see why there are wedding planners. Holy shit!
There's a lot of work
stuff that goes into it.
You guys got experience. Are you guys looking for a side gig?
Yeah, true. It's that we project managed that, and then we project managed the build here. It was so funny. There was a guy who came in to have a look because the real estate agent for this building is like, he just brings people in here to try and like sell people and see, this is what it could be if you did some work. Anyway, and they're like, oh, who did your design? They're like, we did. And they're like, oh, could we hire you? Which is fucking hilarious.
What was the biggest challenge in terms of planning your wedding?
Well, the time we got married, the biggest challenge was COVID, to be honest.
Mm.
It was going to be April or February 20, 20, and then like this started happening and I made the decision straight away to bump it because I just had a feeling this is like, this is going to be intense. And then luckily I just picked a good month. It was April 2021. So it was the time here where we were not in lockdown. There was still a cap. That was probably the biggest issue. Other than that, it was fine. I mean, budgeting for it was fine. You know, when you're in like a – Lauren's an only child. I've got a WOG family. They're always going to chip in money. I don't know. It seemed – in hindsight, it was okay. It was just like a lot of stuff to do. It's just – there's just stuff. You're just always doing something. It's like going on a very, very big holiday where you're just constantly having to do – sort out some little thing like
yeah. –
you know, you've arranged like your makeup person or your nails person or the dress or the shoes or the hands and like just it's endless.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So you just got to just start doing it.
Let's look forward to it.
Yeah. Amanda, what about you? What excites you the most for the next 2 years?
I think really just the growth of the company. I think there's a lot of potential where we're going now and there's not a lot of furniture brands out there doing what we're doing. Just being able to reach the goal of being able to furnish your house with the click of a button. I think that is what we're aiming for. And I think the next 2 years with our product lines continuing to expand just this year alone, I think we're really making it headway there.
Yeah, yeah. So you feel like now you've gotten through the, not the hard years, but the years of where it's just like bloods, like true tears, you know. The first 2-3 years, it's like tears. Absolutely.
Almost just trying to do things for the first time, launching a product for the first time. I think we've got a few product launches under our belt now to be able to anticipate doomsday scenarios and how do we combat this if this happens or, and a good group of people.
Okay. for all of our guests, we asked some rapid-fire questions to finish things off. We're going to ask you both the same question. Make sure it's rapid, though. Don't, you know, some people like to sit and it's got to be just bang, straight from the head.
All right.
Okay. What's in the fridge at home?
Coconut water.
Okay.
Marlo's pet food.
Marlo's pet food. Okay, sick. Do you get, like, one of those fancy...
I have a shout out to Leica pet food.
Yes, that's it. Lauren's been talking about it. I think she actually mentioned she saw it on like your stories or something with the dog.
Yeah.
What breed is that dog, by the way?
He is a Jack Russell Cross Maltese.
Yeah, that's right.
5 years old this year.
It's the long haired Jack Russellness about it.
Yeah.
It's sick. okay. Drink of choice. You go first.
Gin and tonic.
Gin and tonic? Any particular gin?
Oh, I like when it stick with Hendrix.
Okay, sick. I like a good Hendrix.
Just gin, really.
Gin? You're both gin
straight
guys.
Up.
I'm actually the gin person. I'm not sure why I'm manager.
Oh, what a
excuse
burn.
Me.
Wow, shit.
What's your favorite?
Yeah, what's your gin?
Four Pillars pretty good.
Why does anyone like Four Pillars? I like
the Navy Strength one. Like,
Even Roku gin is pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty
Roku
good.
Roku gin is elite. We've got Roku here and Hendrix. I don't know why. I'm with you. Hendrix, it was part of that old guard of gins. Mm. And then all these new small distillery like Four Pillars, Roku.
Yeah.
Roku's been around for ages, but do you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
And Hendrix, there's just something beautiful about it. Like it's floral, it's nice, it's, I don't know, love it.
I'm not sure. Maybe I'm a mainstream kind of guy now.
Yeah, maybe you like do you like the hardcore?
Yeah,
you said Navy Strength, right?
Yeah, Navy Strength, yeah.
Jesus.
I love it.
That's intense. Ken and Amanda, where can people find you guys on the interwebs?
You guys can find us on eva.com.au. Yeah. Otherwise, just reach out on LinkedIn.
So LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. Yeah. Always happy to chat.
Amanda, what about you?
Yeah, LinkedIn or hit us up on Instagram. At eva.home.
Guys, thank you so much for coming in.
And, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure having you on.
Likewise, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much
for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe. And of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. For behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.